Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
President Bush and the Department of Homeland Security knew that the levees had been breached in New Orleans the day the hurricane hit. The administration has said they did not know until the next day. In his testimony before the Senate Homeland Security Committee today, Brown painted a picture of a system that was broken, and he blamed much of the blame on Homeland Security. Spencer Hsu is Homeland Security reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us on the line. Welcome, Spencer.
Hi, Robin. Good to be with you.
You know, Mike Brown, as we're seeing, is not going down without a fight. But I'm wondering, first of all, set the scene for us. How's that being taken by senators there? Because, as we know, Mike Brown has been criticized as being, well, perhaps a political appointee, someone without the credentials for this big job. So how are they treating him?
You know, Mike Brown is sort of in the eye of the beholder right now as the person in the center of this federal response. He's also become the center of the blame game. Democrats are taking his testimony and drawing from it conclusions that the Department of Homeland Security is a massive failure and suffered from a culture clash, and also that the White House may not have acted in time. Republicans are turning back and saying, well, we know that there are organizational problems, but leadership, strong leadership, can overcome those challenges, and that Mike Brown's credibility obviously is challenged by his own acknowledgement that he contributed to much of the failure.
Well, let's hear some of the things that he is saying. He said that for months he'd been calling for more money to deal with the Katrina. He never got it. Senator Susan Collins of Maine asked Mike Brown very pointedly, who did he talk to in the White House? He said he called Deputy Chief of Staff Joe Hagan, who was with President Bush at Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch, and he told him that the big one had hit New Orleans. Let's listen.
I think I told him that we were realizing our worst nightmare, that everything that we had planned about, worried about, that FEMA, frankly, had worried about for 10 years was coming true.
So, Spencer Hsu, did he ever say that he talked directly to President Bush?
He said the way he put it was that he didn't, frankly, pay much attention or notice if President Bush was on the line or not. Sometimes he was on with Hagan, sometimes he wasn't. He said he didn't mean to sound arrogant in response to questioning from the senators, but that his point was to get the message across, and whether he was speaking to Hagan or White House Chief of Staff Andy Card, he assumed that he was speaking directly to the president.
What else jumped out at you today?
Sort of a broader point and some specific issues. When Mike Brown testified before in September to House investigators, he made a point to say that it was a state and local issue, that he pointed the finger in that direction, that he couldn't get a unified command established with the governor of Louisiana or the mayor of New Orleans in the immediate aftermath. Today he took a bit more pointed stand, directed against the administration, or at least against the Department of Homeland Security. He said that when DHS was created 2 years ago, when it folded FEMA in and made it no longer an independent agency reporting to the president, it set FEMA on a path to failure. He said that the course was going to be continued, FEMA was going to be continued to be doomed to fail if this wasn't corrected. He said that he didn't speak with Secretary Chertoff directly for the first day because he thought that would have been a waste of his time, that he said he wanted to speak directly to the White House. This was something that Republicans and Democrats on the committee paid close attention to. They said that this showed that there was this fundamental breakdown in how the government responded. There was sort of a pervasive lack of attention to basic elements of preparedness from natural hazards, that is hurricanes and tornadoes, as well as terrorism.
But then, as we said, some are pointing the finger at, well, as Mike Brown. Republican Senator Norm Coleman said that Brown should hold a mirror up to himself and take some of the blame for the government's failure in Katrina. Here's part of that exchange.
You didn't provide the leadership, even with structural infirmities. Strong leadership can overcome that, and clearly that wasn't the case here.
Well, Senator, that's very easy for you to say, sitting behind that dais and not being there in the middle of that disaster, watching that human suffering and watching those people dying and trying to deal with those structural dysfunctionalities even within the federal government.
Again, the structural dysfunctionalities being, in Mike Brown's opinion, the fact that FEMA was rolled into the Department of Homeland Security. Spencer Hsu, about a minute left. What sense do you get of what's coming out of today?
Investigators believe that they're very close to wrapping up their work and being able to lay out a clear roadmap of, massive failures at all levels of government. There are some new specific findings about The White House and the Department of Homeland Security's failure to react to initial reports of sort of worst-case scenarios, catastrophic failure of the levees and the drowning of New Orleans in that first critical day when earlier action could have made a difference for, you know, tens of thousands of people who were stranded. A lot of the details are new. The general outlines are well known. But what is going to happen is this is going to set the ball off for the next several days, if not weeks, of a series of findings from the House, the Senate, the White House itself, and then proposals for change before the next hurricane starts June 1st.
Okay. Well, later in the program, we're going to hear from someone in New Orleans to see if they're even listening at this point to these long hearings as they go about their business of putting a city back together. Spencer Hsu, Homeland Security reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for your time.
Well, the controversy over the Bush administration's domestic surveillance program continues. Yesterday, administration officials briefed members of the Senate Intelligence Committee on the program. The ranking Democrat on the committee, Senator Jay Rockefeller, is still calling for a full inquiry, while Republicans are saying many of their concerns have been satisfied. James Risen is the New York Times reporter who, along with Eric Lischbau, broke the story about the NSA program last December. The New York Times waited a year before running the story and then published it just as James Risen's new book detailing the program was due to come out. The title of the book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. And he joins us now. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this week, following the hearings, the administration changed course and agreed to hold closed-door meetings with the House and Senate Intelligence Committee, as we said. Was anything learned about the program in those briefings?
Well, I'm not sure. We still don't know exactly what was said. It's all classified, and because of the controversy surrounding this, you know, people have been very reluctant to talk about what was said in those briefings.
Well, we do know that at least one Democrat came out of the meetings who had been opposed to the program, came out saying, you know, I actually may change my mind.
You know, the administration all along has been saying, you know, if people knew more about this program, maybe they would support it. And so it was always a question why they weren't willing to make more of a case to people in the, you know, in the intelligence committees before this.
Well, and some are saying because of security. I'm sure you read Porter Goss, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, had an op-ed piece in today's New York Times saying, in fact, that it's the leak of the program that's the problem. Alberto Gonzalez, during the hearings, attorney general, said the same thing. I think his words were something like, our enemies are shaking their heads and saying, we can't believe this is leaked.
Right.
You were part of the leak. How do you feel about that sort of redirecting of the attention from?
You can't really have a democracy without a free press and without a vigorous press, and that issues like this have to be debated in public because this issue is so close to the nexus between national security and civil liberties that this is an issue that I don't think that you can have a debate over without some checks and balances in society.
Do you think that the fact that the program has been discussed now has stopped surveillance, has perhaps let bad guys off the hook, has endangered American lives?
I don't believe so, no.
Well, yesterday, President Bush announced a 2002 al-Qaeda plot against the Library Tower in Los Angeles that he says was foiled by U.S. officials. After the Senate briefing yesterday, Senator Feinstein, Dianne Feinstein, said she thought the administration was linking blocking that plot to information gathered through the NSA secret program. But as she said, how can you tell? Do you know?
I don't know specifically, but you could also read the Washington Post today where several intelligence officials told the Post that they don't even know if that plot was real. And that they think that the Post said that people in the intelligence community were critical of the way that President Bush handled that and said that they thought it was for political purposes.
Well, the Bush administration does seem to be on a PR offensive to defend the program. Let's remind ourselves some of the history, which you really give us insight to in your book, State of War. It's the largest domestic spying operation since the Vietnam War. It was started in 2001 by the Bush administration. The NSA, then headed by Michael Hayden, designed the program to go around the FISA courts, which were set up to prohibit this kind of warrantless spying on Americans. And as you write, I mean, one of the fascinating things that I take from your book is how many American telephone companies are involved in this.
Right. Yeah, I mean, what they did was get the approval of some key telecommunications corporations to provide access to key hubs within the telecommunications network, in which they could then gain access to the kind of the bloodstream of the American telecommunications system.
And the international telecommunications system. You point out, too, that in setting up the program, the Bush administration and other operatives were able to get international calls strictly between foreigners routed through the United States.
Right. That was one of the initial justifications for the program, was the idea that there is a lot of what they call transit traffic going through the United States from, say, Asia to Europe, where calls get routed physically through networks that are on American soil, and they wanted access to, you know, to those phone calls, and in addition to the ability to eavesdrop on calls inside the United States.
Yeah. And they had these, what are they called, gateway switches and trapdoors?
Right. What they have done essentially is kind of latch on to the switches that are at the borders of the American the borders between the American telecommunications network and the international telecommunications network, and they grab emails and telephone calls as they go between the two.
How many have you estimated?
The best estimates that we had was that they eavesdrop on about 500 people who are inside the United States at any one time, and then they are also listening to 5,000 to 7,000 people overseas as well. You know, the number of people inside the United States that they've actually eavesdropped on without warrants is in the thousands.
And of those, do we know how many actually led to any kind of information?
The best estimates we've seen so far is that very few. The New York Times did a story in January in which FBI officials and other law enforcement officials were very dismissive of the program and said that it had not provided very much information of use.
Well, getting back to Porter Goss's op-ed piece today in the New York Times, he writes, "Those who bypass the law and go straight to the press are not noble, patriotic, or honorable. They are committing a criminal act that potentially places American lives at risk." How would you describe the people who came forward to talk to you about this warrantless spy program?
I think they're whistleblowers. I think they're American patriots. And I think that, frankly, it's not up to the CIA director to determine this kind of thing.
James Risen, one of the New York Times reporters who broke the story of the NSA's domestic surveillance program. His new book is called State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. When we come back, how intelligence errors actually an email mistake led to the firing or killing of every agent in Iran, how the U.S. actually gave nuclear bomb designs to Iran. Much more ahead here and now. Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. And Jim, the last chapter of your book deals with Iran, so I want to speak about that for a minute. You say that while the U.S. had no spies in Iraq, one reason the CIA was leery of going into Iraq, the U.S. did have spies in Iran. But somewhat recently, the Iranians learned about this network, and so the U.S. is now operating as blind in Iran as it was in Iraq in the run-up to the war there. Tell us how this happened.
In 2004... A CIA officer inadvertently downloaded information that could help identify a whole network of Iranian spies, and downloaded it to one spy, and basically put the entire network of Iranian agents that the CIA had at risk.
Because that spy turned out to be a double agent.
That's what I was told. Now, mm-hmm. Since my book came out, the CIA says no. We don't think that did lead to the arrest of all these people, but they they don't deny that this incident happened and that it led to a huge investigation inside, a damage assessment inside the CIA of what went wrong. Mm. So the question now is, do we have any decent intelligence coming out of Iran?
Which, of course, was the problem in Iraq.
Right.
Well, there's another, I think, little-known U.S. intelligence failure in Iran, Operation Merlin, in which the U.S. essentially gave the Iranian government blueprints for building a nuclear weapon. Can you describe Operation Merlin to us, how it was supposed to work and why it didn't?
Right. Yeah, this was 6 years ago. It's actually before Bush became president.
It was in the Clinton administration.
It was in the Clinton administration. It was where they handed flawed nuclear blueprints over to the Iranians through a Russian defector. And the idea was it was going to send the Iranians down the wrong technical path, but the way it was handled raised questions about whether or not we'd actually aided them instead.
You have incredible detail in your book of, you know, behind-the-scenes moments, and one that jumps out at me is when some, I think it was a Bush administration official, is wandering around as Iran is heating up and saying something like, whatever happened to those plans that we sent?
Right.
Sort of the thinking being, geez, now they might actually use them.
Right. Seems to me that they didn't think through the consequences.
Well, there seemed to be a lot of that that you detail in the book of different agencies, you know, sort of pulling pranks almost and not really thinking through what the consequences might be.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the problems on Iraq was that there were a lot of efforts to think of ideas that were really kind of brazen, but were not particularly well thought through. And you could say that, I guess, about the invasion of Iraq in general was there was virtually no planning for what would happen after the initial invasion.
At the end of your book, you say that the rise of the neoconservatives in the Bush administration had been one of the biggest surprises in that administration. And then you go on to say how Iraq marked their decline and fall. And we've been noting that as well, that so many of the names of the neoconservatives, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, even John Yoo, I'm not sure a neoconservative, but certainly a conservative lawyer who actually wrote the first paper sort of indicating that the NSA secret spying program would be okay. A lot of these names are gone.
Because things have gone so poorly in Iraq, it's difficult for them to continue to make the same cases that they did before. And so it'll be interesting to see how far the administration goes from here in terms of continuing to press the same ideas that they did in the first administration.
Do you see any evidence that the administration is rethinking its policies?
Well, I think there is evidence that that they may eventually be forced to pull out of Iraq or at least withdraw some troops from Iraq. They seem to be signaling a drawdown of troops this year, despite, you know, having criticized people last year who said that we should begin to withdraw troops.
But your book sort of paints a picture of a government really kind of broken in many ways, with people jockeying for position. And
yeah, I think that the theme I think I was trying to get at in the book was that there was a lack of checks and balances after 9/11 within the government, that the principals, the war cabinet was meeting just about every day and setting policies on the fly, and kind of the experts within the government didn't have time to catch up.
In fact, I'm looking for the line now. You say that we actually went to war in Iraq without everybody really even meeting on it.
Right, yeah. There was never any real debate about it. And even with at the highest levels, there was not a formal debate about, you know, that Bush called and said, okay, what do you guys think? And so it was kind of a very strange period, I think, in American history where, things just kind of happened. And, you talk to people who left the government afterwards, and a lot of them kind of had this dazed look as if they just survived a car crash.
James Risen, one last question. You know, we began talking about the NSA secret wiretapping program that you broke the story in the New York Times. What do you hear from people? Because, you know, when you just sort of listen to the ground, you hear a lot of Americans say, well, if that's what it takes to keep me safe, I see no problem with it.
Well, I think I hear both sides. People say that, but a lot of other people say this is something that we have to know about. As I said, there's always going to be a debate and tension between national security and civil liberties, and I think we have to recognize that, and that's the role of the press not to make decisions on where that comes out, but to just let the public know about things, and then they can decide. I think the American people may decide that this is fine for the government to do, which is fine. I just think it's important for the press to make that information public so that people can then make up their own minds.
Do you expect to be called to testify about it? Do you expect there to be hearings? Do you expect to be asked who your sources were?
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I hope not.
James Risen, one of the New York Times reporters who broke the story of the NSA wiretapping program. His book is entitled State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Much more ahead, including Ziggy Marley on his dad, on his dad's birthday. That's Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. In Turin, Italy, and already the U.S. has had a couple of setbacks. Zach Lund, the top U.S. slider on the men's skeleton team. That's the sport where they slid down the course head first. He was banned from the games for taking a hair restoration pill that can be used to mask steroid use. And the U.S. also lost its seat on the International Olympic Committee Executive Board today when Jim Easton, who had been vice president of the committee, lost in a secret ballot to a South African. Earlier today, we spoke to Los Angeles Times sports reporter Helene Elliott in Turin and asked her first what the loss of this seat means for the U.S.
Nothing good. It seems that the International Olympic Committee and everybody else likes to take the TV money that America generates, but they don't want to give any American sports officials any influence in major decisions.
And we understand that yesterday, I think, two sports dear to the hearts of Americans were voted down in a bid to get them back into the Olympics. What were they, softball and...
And baseball.
Well, there you go. And so it seems as if there's... What is the committee saying?
I think you can kind of argue in terms of baseball and softball that in terms of baseball certainly, that the best players in the world weren't participating. But I think softball is really cruel. It's played widely enough around the world, I think. But I think, again, a lot of people interpret that as a direct shot at America.
And before we leave this topic, I'm just putting in some context for us. How unusual is that to have no Americans on the International Olympic Committee?
It's kind of a reflection of political sentiment around the world. And as much as people say that sports should be separate from politics, it's probably impossible to separate them.
And we should say, just as the games begin, another topic that becomes very political raises its head. There were some athletes suspended for failing blood tests, a number of cross-country skiers, including two Americans, suspended for 5 days. But the kind of test they had, apparently, it could just be from dehydration, some are saying, so... No real excitement yet, but it brings the question, how tightly are the athletes being monitored at this Olympics?
At every succeeding Olympics, they say that this is going to be the toughest drug testing ever because, you know, as quickly as tests are developed to detect drugs, the people who make these things are trying to stay a step ahead, and it's a difficult race. I mean, you can never actually win it because there's new substances being developed and found all the time.
Mm. Well, speed skater Chris Whitty is going to be carrying the U.S. flag in the opening ceremonies. This is a wonderful story, actually. This is her fifth Olympics. Tell us, though, about her personal story, which has come to light.
She's a very interesting person, and for many years she had kept a secret and had not told anyone about being abused as a child by a family friend, and she said she always kept it pent up within her. She never felt comfortable talking to anybody about it. And finally, a few years ago, she did talk to someone about it, and she's felt a lot more free, and she's felt a lot better about herself and about her life since then. And she's become a beacon for a lot of people who've suffered similar abuse. Yeah. And it takes a lot of courage to go public with something like that.
Speaks to children's groups. She was voted flag bearer, you know, so that says something about how she's viewed. Gold medalist in 2002. Is she expected to win big, or is she more symbolic this time around?
It's more symbolic. This is, again, her fifth Olympics. She said the other day that this will probably be her last game. So I think it's kind of a career reward. I mean, she's certainly a medal contender. I wouldn't call her a favorite, but she certainly has the possibility of winning one.
Well, another American Olympian who doesn't seem afraid of talking about anything is Bodie Miller. They're going to be skiing this weekend, and there are a couple of medal possibilities for the U.S., Darren Rawls and Bodie Miller, who won some silver medals in events in 2002. But he, of course, made huge news before the Olympics when he went on 60 Minutes and seemed to imply that he has skied while drunk. So
Bodie is a wonderful self-promoter. As good a skier as he is, he's even better as a self-promoter. Kind of like the Britney Spears, I think, of skiers, in that every time he seems to be out of the headlines for a minute or two, he says something or does something that gets him back into the headlines. So Bodie claims to not like establishment rules and all that kind of stuff, and in the meantime, he's signed with some very major corporations, and he's a spokesman for several products, and if that's not establishment, I don't know what that is.
Well, when, how is he expected to ski? I mean, is he going to do well, or...?
It depends. I think the weather's going to be a factor. You can never really prepare for what the course conditions are going to be like. He has not had as good a season this season as he did last year, so there's some question as to whether he'll be able to duplicate the success he had last season. And you know, it's just so unpredictable.
We're talking to Helene Elliott of the Los Angeles Times. She's in Turin getting ready for this weekend's launch of the Olympics. And figure skating, always big in the television ratings. But this year, a new scoring system. We understand the skaters, some of the skaters at least, don't like it because it makes them more robotic. Explain this system and the impact it's having on the skaters.
I don't necessarily know robotic. I think that this is still the early years of this system. This is the first time it will be used at the Olympics. Under this system, each jump or spin has a fixed value, and the judges can add points or deduct points for how well that move is executed. And the skaters also get marks for choreography and skating skills and transitions and things like that. It's designed to avoid a repeat of what happened at Salt Lake City, to make it impossible to fix a result, although I don't think anything's ever impossible, but this would certainly make it harder.
Yeah, and just the criticism we're hearing is that skaters say that there'll be less accent on, you know, the subjective.
Well, I mean, this is a subjective sport, just as gymnastics or diving, and as long as you have a human element to that, as long as it's not, you know, one person just beating another person across the finish line, there's always going to be the possibility of flim-flammery, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. Part of figure skating is its subjectivity. That's a wonderful thing and a terrible thing at the same time.
Well, Helene, while we have you there in Turin, as you well know, big story here in the U.S., and you cover the National Hockey League for the Los Angeles Times, so we just want to ask you, there's this growing gambling scandal allegedly involving a Phoenix Coyote assistant hockey coach and hockey great Wayne Gretzky's wife, Janet Jones, former actress. You sort of need a guide to follow. And there's been talk that, you know, Wayne Gretzky might even have known about this alleged, you know, gambling ring and his wife's involvement. How big is this?
It has the potential to be huge. I mean, the preliminary indications are that none of the people involved bet on hockey games, but we don't know that for certain. The investigation is still going on. And a number of sources have reported that Gretzky is heard on a tape discussing the gambling ring with Rick Tocchet, the assistant coach, and discussing how to keep his wife's name out of it. So there's a lot of ugly things, ugly potential there, but we just have to wait and see how it all unfolds.
Mm. Helene Elliott speaking to us from Turin, Italy, about the Olympics, which will launch this weekend, and also a little bit about the gambling scandal in the NHL, which we'll keep an eye on. Helene, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, the global love affair with the late reggae star Bob Marley. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, as we reported earlier, former FEMA Director Michael Brown told senators today that the Department of Homeland Security and the White House knew on Monday, the day that Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, that levees were breached, while the Bush administration has said they didn't know until Tuesday. Barbara Major is a community activist and the co-commissioner of the Bring New Orleans Back Commission. Barbara, what do you think of this disparity?
What else is new? Somebody lied at the White House? You know, okay, that's what has been happening, the incompetence. They passed the torch of who was incompetent when actually we know everybody from the bottom up was incompetent in terms of handling the rescue of people out of New Orleans.
Well, in fact, FEMA Director Mike Brown is saying that there's a lot of blame to go around. That FEMA official in New Orleans, Marty Bahamonde, said on Monday night that conditions were far more serious than people thought, that they sent emails to the White House. And he, Mike Brown, says that the problem is structural, that in 2003, FEMA was rolled into the Department of Homeland Security, and that change resulted in a culture clash. Let's listen.
It's my belief that had there been a report come out from Marty Bahamonde that said, yes, we've confirmed that a terrorist has blown up the 17th Street Canal levee, then everybody would have jumped all over that. And so you now have these two systems operating, one which cares about terrorism, and FEMA and our state and local partners who are trying to approach everything from all hazards.
Barbara, back to you. Do you think there was a disconnect because there's too much bureaucracy and because it didn't seem as serious as, say, a terrorist attack?
Well, definitely they didn't take it as serious as a terrorist attack. Secondly, I think we need to make sure when we say it was a natural disaster, because the divestment from building the levees and the incompetence of maintaining the levees before Katrina makes it not natural, but man-made disaster. It was part natural and part man-made, but it wouldn't have been to the degree that it was if they had dealt with the levees appropriately prior to Katrina. They breached because they had not been taken care of in the beginning.
And Barbara, I just wonder, as these hearings go on and there's a lot of finger-pointing and a lot of yelling back and forth, what do people in New Orleans think? Does it matter to people there who's to blame at this point?
You know, I can't speak for everybody in New Orleans. I'm sure to a lot of people it matters to who's to blame, because somebody has to be held and some bodies have to be held accountable so that it doesn't happen anywhere else. Because what happened in New Orleans could happen with an earthquake in San Francisco or flooding in New Jersey. I mean, it can happen again anywhere.
Well, a recent General Accountability Office report says that the government still isn't ready to respond to a hurricane of Katrina's magnitude. Given that, you know, what's happening there? We hear stories of people who want to move back into their homes, people who want to move out of their homes, people trying to sell their homes. I know you can't speak for everyone, but what kinds of things are you hearing?
It's up in the air. A lot of people who want to go back and rebuild, and people should have the right who want to go back to rebuild. For folk who don't, then there should be fair, equitable compensation for people who lost their homes, because they lost their homes not just because of a natural disaster, but they lost their homes and their whole way of living because of what people did not do. It demonstrated to me, and I think hundreds of thousands of people, we're not ready to protect and take care of home, let alone going somewhere else talking about we're going to help somebody else take care of themselves and have democracy. It would be a really cool thing if we had it here first.
Barbara Major, a community activist and the co-commissioner of the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, speaking to her about today's hearings. And Barbara, I was struck by something. Here you are at the center of this. Are you watching the hearings?
No, I'm not.
Why not?
And I'm sure a lot of people are glued to the television watching the hearings. How do some of us maintain our sanity? We just can't hear the lies over and over and over again. And for me, Brown's like one rat ratting out a bunch of other rats. And it's like, no, I'm not watching that. I know. I'll read about it, and folk will talk about it. But it's like, we know that there was incompetence, and we know that there was a whole bunch of folk dropped the ball. And my position is, if you are a human being, I don't care what position you are in, I don't care how many emails were sent, you should have been screaming and hollering that something was wrong.
Barbara Major, a community activist and the co-commissioner of the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, speaking to us from Houston, where she took refuge from this storm. Barbara, thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
Well, stay with us. We'll have much more ahead, including the celebration of Bob Marley's life Here and Now. Now, reggae fans throughout the world are celebrating reggae superstar Bob Marley's birthday. He would be 61 years old this week, and in death, he's become an international symbol of freedom, his face beaming from T-shirts and posters all over the globe. His message was simple.
True peace and love and music, you know, and liberty.
Bob Marley died of cancer 26 years ago, but his fusion of music, religion, and politics elevated him to quasi-deity status for millions. This week, Marley fans and scholars gathered in Accra, Ghana, for Africa Unite, featuring lectures, symposia, and of course, music. That's the song Slogans from Africa Unite, the singles collection, a new release to celebrate Marley's birthday. It's the first new song from Bob Marley in 20 years. Slogans was recorded in a Miami bedroom in 1979. In this new production, Eric Clapton overdubs the guitar track. Bob and Rita Marley's oldest son, Ziggy, and his brother, Stephen, produce the new single. And Ziggy Marley joins us from Lion's Head Studios in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
How did you find this long-lost song?
You know, it was my grandmother who had some things that dad had left at the home in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had given her some things to keep for him, and that was in the stuff that he gave her.
Oh, how nice to find that, sort of like a message from the past.
True.
And you overdub it with, as we said, Eric Clapton playing guitar.
Yeah.
And he's kind of, you know, interesting. What's your father's relationship? What's your relationship to Eric Clapton, given that he introduced many people to reggae with I Shot the Sheriff?
I shot the sheriff, but I swear it was in self-defense. I shot the sheriff, and they say it.
That's where the relationship started. You know, him doing that song, and then always, he's an open musician and a very nice person. So we gave him a call and we spoke to him, and he said he would love to do it.
You hit such a huge hit with that. Were, you know, people like your father ever jealous of that, given that, you know, they really had given birth to the sound?
No. I mean, it only helped, you know, helped my father's music to reach a wide variety of people, so there's no jealousy. My father is not a jealous person, so there's no jealousy there.
Well, we want to listen to more of your father. Here he is in a 1980 interview, and he was asked when he became a Rasta. Let's listen.
Well, I've been a Rasta from ever since. It's not an easy thing to explain in an educated standard that we are. Still, you have people who can do it. But me, a common sense man. That means when me explain things, me explain it in a very simple way. That means if I explain it to a baby, the baby will understand too, you know?
A common sense man. You can explain it to a baby.
Yeah.
Ziggy Marley, as we listen to your dad, I'm reminded of an interview at around the same time, and I apologize because I've interviewed them both. I can't remember if it was your dad or Peter Tosh.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that same sort of struggle trying to figure out what is this, and I said, okay, what is this Rastafarianism? And they said, Rastafari ain't no ism.
Right.
Can you explain what your father's belief is? Can you explain that?
Yeah, it is beyond religion. Was born from the oppression that Jamaican people felt from slavery days, when we were being brainwashed into the belief of the slave owners. You know, whatever religion they believe, they would brainwash us into that, and so a consciousness arose to fight against that brainwash.
Well, your father practiced that belief, and with it he transcended music, became a spiritual figure to others. You were awfully young when he died, so what is your memory of your dad?
My memory, he's everything to me. Prophet, teacher, father. Daddy was a happy person, a good, you know, fun-loving person. You know, so he's in my thoughts all the while.
Well, we mentioned the Africa Unite release, and there's a new DVD edition of Bob Marley and the Wailers live at the Rainbow as well.
Yeah.
That video of that performance is the only music video that the New York Times put in its Millennium Time Capsule.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts on that?
As my father said, he's a simple man, common sense man. You know, it's good, but we don't put too much emphasis on things like that, you know?
What do you put emphasis on?
We put emphasis on God, you know, on love, on life.
Well, Ziggy Marley, thank you so much for sharing some time with us on this day.
Come on, thank you.
Just come to break down oppression, rule equality here. Wipe away transgression, set the captives free. Set the captives free. Set the captives free.
We're joined now by Bob Marley biographer Stephen Davis. And Stephen, as we said, you know, Bob Marley seems to have transcended music and has become a spiritual figure. Can you explain that? I mean, can you tell us some of the ways that he's viewed around the world?
Well, yeah, you know, in Australia, there's not much figurative art among the Aboriginal people, but Bob Marley figures almost everywhere. In the American Southwest, there's a tribe of Indians that live in the bottom of the Grand Canyon called the Havasupai, who have rituals dedicated to Bob Marley. So, yes, Bob Marley has become a god, you know, and what's great about Bob is how far he came, you know, from the slums of Trenchtown, the concrete jungle, some of the worst slums in the Western Hemisphere, and most people don't realize he was something of a gangster. You know, he was an outsider. He did jail time for selling ganja in Jamaica.
Well, tell us a little bit about why. I mean, he grew up the son of a black Jamaican woman and a white father. Did that biracial identity, you know, have something to do with that outsider life?
Well, I think so, because he was an outsider to both black Jamaicans and white Jamaicans. There were black Jamaicans who resented his light skin, and on the other hand, white Jamaica rejected the black side of him. And it hardened him, I think. You know, he was a very tough guy. If the latest Wailers single wasn't getting airplay on the JBC in Jamaica, they would show up with cricket bats and work over the DJ's cars until they made sure that they were getting airplay.
We understand the music of Bob Marley and the Wailers still makes up half of the sales of reggae music?
Oh, I would imagine that that's probably true. This compilation Legend is the biggest selling catalog item in the history of the music business. It's hard to hear No Woman, No Cry and fail to be moved by, you know, the incredible poignancy and sensitivity of a guy who could also, you know, write some of the most militant and angry songs of his generation. So, you know, it's quality aesthetics, Robin. It just keeps on moving.
Stephen Davis, Bob Marley biographer. Stephen, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Again, Bob Marley would be 61 years old this week. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Karen Miller-Medson, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugars is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Jessica Gerard, Angela Kim, and Daniel Estrin. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.